Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We've got two authors discussing war journalists. Neil MacDonald makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here some years ago talking about Damien Parra, and here tonight talking about his most recent book, Valiant for Truth, The Life of Chester Wilmot, War Correspondent. And Neil MacDonald is a historian and a film critic. And he will speak first. Then Tony Hill makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He is the author of Voices from the Air, the subtitle being ABC War Correspondents of the Second World War. And Tony Hill, as some of you will know, is managing editor of ABC News 24. So thanks to both our speakers. We'll start with Neil, we'll go to Tony, then we'll go to questions and discussion. Thank you.
Well, this is actually Wilmot versus Blamey. And it's a few selections of some of the most interesting discoveries I made while researching both Chester Wilmot reports, which is an earlier book of his dispatches, and Valiant for Truth. And when Chester Wilmot returned to Australia from the Middle East early in 1942, he was already something of a celebrity. He'd been born in Melbourne in 1911. He was a graduate of the University of Melbourne, and he'd been also president of the SRC at the University of Melbourne, where he'd been campaigning for better conditions along with the vice-chancellor, Joseph Priestley. Chester had originally intended to become a lawyer. Indeed, he'd been completing his articles when the war broke out. However, Chester had always been attracted to journalism. He had been an occasional broadcaster on the ABC in the late 30s and published a number of anti-Nazi articles based on his experiences in Europe during the Munich crisis. He had also attracted the attention of ABC general manager Charles Moses. I didn't meet many people in the Wilmot story, but he was one of the ones I did meet. Admittedly, he was in old age, but he was in fine shape. This led to Wilmot becoming the ABC's principal broadcaster in the Middle East. He'd covered the first time the Australians went to the battle in the Second World War. He helped craft a new Anzac legend with his broadcasts from Tobruk. And Wilmot's reporting, too, was rather special because it was based on confidential briefings by the military at every level from private soldier to general. And in this, his contacts in Melbourne, because of his father's role as a very distinguished sporting journalist, had been invaluable. Well, Wilmot's return to Australia was everything he might have hoped. He'd come along with a carefully prepared case for an increase in salary, and it was brushed aside by the acting general manager of the ABC, T.W. Bearup, and he said, oh, no, and then proceed to offer him even more money. We all should have bosses like that. He then married his sweetheart. He married Edith Irwin, a very attractive girl, we have to say, of that period. He'd been courting by mail from various fronts in the Middle East, and trenches as well. He used to write them in a trench sometimes. I'm just about to go into an attack. And he had made a plan for the ABC's coverage of the new conflicts in the Pacific. And this had been extremely well received, and we might hear more of this from Tony in a little while. Chester was also appointed the head of ABC's broadcasting unit in New Guinea. But the return was not an undiluted triumph. He did a thoughtful broadcast on tank tactics in the Middle East. And then there was a ban by the military censors. For 2 months, he wasn't supposed to broadcast on the Desert War. And it came from military censorship, and it's still a little bit of a puzzle, because Chester was describing British tank tactics and certainly wasn't saying anything that the Germans didn't already know. But from the beginning, there had been tension between Chester and the ABC's broadcast unit in the Middle East and the commander of the AIF, Sir Thomas Blamey, another Victorian. Well, he's a Victorian, had a Victorian career, although he started his career in New South Wales. In January 1941, Chester was about to cover the assault on Bardia, which was the first time the Australians went into action in the Second World War. And he was back in Cairo, and he was ordered by Blamey to go and cover some speeches by himself, Blamey, and the Minister for the Army, Percy Spender. Chester protested vehemently, but Blamey said there was no alternative, and he then went off to Palestine, made the recording, and then drove the 1,000-odd miles back to Bardia. Lawrence H. Cecil, the administrative head of the unit, immediately protested to the government, and Blamey was told in no uncertain terms he didn't have the authority over to do that sort of thing with the ABC unit. And after this, Wilmot, of course, who was knew Melbourne very well and Blamey's time as police commissioner, became very suspicious of Sir Thomas Blamey. When Chester came across rumours about the poor quality of the films being shown to the troops, and that the Australian commander was supposed to be benefiting improperly from transactions with a certain Albert Shafto, who was a leading distributor of films in the Middle East, he thought he ought to investigate. He managed to get a chance to meet the officer in charge of amenities, and then Blamey himself. Their reactions, as described in Chester's notes, were enough to make him, if anything, even more suspicious. The amenities officer jumped to his feet and shouted, "That's a matter for the Commander-in-Chief," as soon as he asked a question. Blamey just rather sullenly evaded Wilmot's questions, but didn't seem to be all that worried. In fact, as Chester discovered, rather unhappily, Blamey was very worried. Not long after Wilmot returned from the Middle East, he was invited to the offices of the solicitors where he'd been completing his articles before the war. Chester had been very happy there and thought they might have a wedding present. In fact, as he told Edith over a coffee that he'd hurried her out, after he'd hurried her out of the office, he'd been warned off through the solicitor by Blamey. "It stinks," he exploded. And indeed, of course, it did. Soon, Wilmot was in Port Moresby with Bill McFarlane, his sound recorders from the Middle East, setting up a studio in the jungle. Now, I couldn't find any photograph of the studio, but my colleague here, Tony Hill, most certainly did, and it's in his book, Voices from the Air. Also in Port Moresby was Department of Information cameraman Damien Parra, and Melbourne Sun correspondent Osmer White, another major figure from Melbourne journalism. Their reporting on film, radio and in print of the fighting on the Kokoda track remain one of the epics of Australian journalism. And it's a quite well-known story. I mean, Osmer Wright published Green Armour quite early, and it's been in all our books, in mine, Peter Brune's and so on. But it wasn't until I met Gordon Darling in 2003 that I came to realise there was much more to the Kokoda story than I'd realised. Now, Darling is best remembered as a philanthropist and also for appointing Gough Whitlam as chairman of the National Gallery, which of course led to that lovely moment where you see him in Roman costume and a laurel wreath in one of the things of advertising, but it's one of the great stories. But in August 1942, he was very handsome, Lieutenant Darling, ADC to the Corps Commander, Lieutenant General Sidney Rao. Darling told me how impressed he was by the seasoned commanders who began to arrive in New Guinea. They, along with Rao, had been blooded in the Middle East and Greece. They were regarded at the time as sort of members of the Middle East Club, men with sand in their shoes. The phrase is often around, you'll see it in a lot of the military histories. According to Darling, Chester Wilmot and Damien Pera were also seen as very much members of the club. In fact, Allen and Rao were friends of Wilmot's, and they were pretty close to Pera. Some of the best photographs of Tubby Allen are actually taken by Damien. This is why Rao was able to enlist the cameraman and broadcaster as liaison officers. This is quite extraordinary. There are plenty of examples of correspondents helping out, but this I haven't come across it before or since. I should add that in violation of all the rules governing the conduct of war correspondents, Wilmot carried a rifle and hand grenades on the Dakota track. Osmond White didn't involve himself to this extent, but he did write a report on the campaign for his boss, Keith Murdoch, and I've been told by Sally White it might surface. It should be very interesting, but there's still work to do in this area. White, too, was armed. Once they joined what was now known as Maroubra Force, the reporters were caught up in the fighting withdrawal when the Japanese broke through at Isuraba. If you want to know where all these places are, you can only open my book, and there's a very good map in there. Wilmot questioned as many of the officers as he could. There's a very good, and our troops were forced to withdraw, which sort of gives you an idea of the process, and it's reproduced in my Chester Wilmot reports. Then, on hearing of the attack in Milne Bay, he and White hurried back down the trail to Moresby. Pera stayed to film the withdrawal. When Chester arrived at Rao's headquarters, Rao and Allen asked him to prepare a report on the campaign. And as far as I know, this was unprecedented, and I doubt if it's ever happened since, which is why Wilmot is such an extraordinary figure in the history of Australian journalism. It looks as though it's come out of a movie of the period, but in fact it's all true. Because more troops were soon to be committed to New Guinea, Rao sent the report to Land Forces headquarters, suggesting it should be copied and distributed. The general told Darling if one of his staff had written anything like that, he'd have made him a brigadier. The report was, of course, very well received, because they didn't know much about what was going on in New Guinea, and it was particularly by the Americans, who were pretty much at sea at this moment. That is until Blamey found out. He had all copies withdrawn and destroyed. The Americans, to their credit, wouldn't have any of it. They kept their copies. The report is very interesting. It's also reproduced in Chester Wilmot reports, and we analyse it. That's one of the chapters I collaborated with Peter Brune on, and there's a very close analysis in the book of it. It's completely objective. It combines a lucid exposition of the strategic blunders that resulted in the Japanese advance to within 35 miles of Port Moresby, with all sorts of detailed suggestions about deficiencies in equipment and how they can be remedied. My favourite recommendation is that each man should be supplied with 23 pairs of shoelaces. Actually, it's not as silly as it sounds, because the boots on the track were very important. And you need to have good boots, and that it would work. And Wilmot has a whole paragraph about the kind of boots that you should have on the Dakota track. Wilmot wrote a lot about the need to supply the troops. Also, he also did that with properly camouflaged uniforms, jungle green. He was not alone in this. Osmond White and Damien Parra had been with his 5th Independent Company when they dyed their uniforms in July, because the khaki stood out against the deep green of the jungle foliage. Blamey, it seems, wasn't interested. At a press conference in Port Moresby, He asked Sir Thomas Blamey how the dyeing of the uniforms was, dyeing them green, was progressing. Blamey replied that khaki had been established as the most effective camouflage. "I can refer you to some hundreds of people here who think otherwise," responded Wilmot dryly. "Not the way to get on well with your Commander-in-Chief." Wilmot's dispatches, based on the information collected for Rowell, skillfully corrected the misconceptions being fed to reporters from General MacArthur's headquarters, sometimes fed to the Australian press. And a close collaborator in all this was the censor Colonel George Fenton, another soldier with sand in his shoes. A fragment of Fenton's diary made available to me by his son through the good offices of Stuart Braga, author of a fine biography of General Allen, cast new light on the command crisis in September 1942 that resulted in the relief of General Rowell and eventually to Chester Wilmot's own disaccreditation. Brigadier Potts' fighting withdrawal was good tactics, but it panicked MacArthur. Under pressure from the American general, Prime Minister John Curtin insisted on Blamey going up to New Guinea to report on the situation. And to his credit, that's exactly what he did. After being briefed by Rowell and Allen, Blamey returned to Australia, explained the situation in a broadcast, and gave his commanders his full support. Then a withdrawal to Itima Ridge to strengthen the line further alarmed MacArthur, and he contacted Curtin and insisted Blamey return to New Guinea. Now, the usual story is Blamey blundered into a situation, a confrontation with Rowell, and dismissed him. And he didn't intend to do it. I don't think it's true. Blamey didn't want to go ashore, and he did write a conciliatory letter to Rowell. But the Fenton diary indicates Rowell didn't believe him. What's more, there's evidence that Blamey determined if he had to go back, he was going to get the credit for the way Rowell had retrieved the situation. Blamey was also going to close down Wilmot's reporting. He brought with him the staunchly conservative Colonel J.H. Rasmussen to replace Fenton as censor and devised a new set of rules for correspondence that, among other things, prevented any reporter talking to a staff officer. There was a spectacular confrontation with Rowell, after which Blamey relieved him of his command. Meanwhile, Fenton hurried Chester away with Rowell not far behind. They met up in Sydney. Chester, through C.W. Bean, the official historian of the Australians in the Great War, and H.V. Evatt, arranged a meeting with Curtin. During his interview with the Prime Minister, Wilmot argued that Blamey had lost the confidence of the Australian Army and that Rowell should be restored to his command. Curtin's reply was, to say the least, disingenuous. "All that you have said is known to the government," he told the reporter. "But General Blamey can predict the moves of the enemy so well that we cannot afford to part with him. It's a matter of back him or sack him, and we can't sack him." This was arrant nonsense. Blamey's predictions came from the intelligence services, and he and MacArthur had failed to heed intelligence that predicted Japan's attack on Moresby until too late. Curtin's reasons for backing Blamey lay elsewhere. In the course of the interview, Wilmot had mentioned he was preparing a report on the campaign. A few days later, the ABC received a letter from the PM demanding to see the report. "I am, after all, Minister for Defence," he ends rather plaintively. Wilmot saw his chance. By now, Blamey had destroyed all the copies of the first report, so Wilmot sort of set about preparing another. Without mentioning his name, the new report is directed straight at Blamey. Quite objectively, it details all the command decisions that led to the reversal. He also corrects a few errors in the original and pays tribute to the successes achieved under Rowell's command. Curtin, however, remained obdurate. It was not long before Blamey moved against Wilmot. He called Chester in, and supported by Rasmussen and the new Corps commander, Edmund Herring, summarily removed Wilmot's accreditation. His pretext is interesting. It was that Chester had continued to investigate the alleged picture fraud after he'd been warned off. Throughout all this, Wilmot had the support of the ABC. He called on Charles Moses, who was actually serving in the army at that time in New Guinea, and secured a letter of support. Wilmot prepared a brilliant defence of his position for the ABC board, who fully supported their reporter. They didn't know what to do about Blamey, but decided to express their confidence by putting Wilmot on the air as often as possible. Wilmot was granted leave and an office to write to Brooke. We all should have employers like that. And, by the way, I should add there's a new edition of To Brooke with an introduction by Peter Cochrane coming out in a few weeks. Wilmot gained another supporter when, at the urgent invitation of the Prime Minister, Charles Moses returned as General Manager. Early in 1944, Moses picked up rumours that Blamey was going to use the Manpower Act to force Wilmot into the army. A latrine unit was waiting, Moses told me. The general manager knew the BBC had been interested in getting Wilmot since he had broadcast for them from Tobruk, so he cabled them. Wilmot is available. They replied with an offer of an assignment to Burma. This was amended to an invitation to join War Report, the body being set up to cover the invasion of Europe. But Wilmot needed the Prime Minister's approval to leave Australia, and this was refused several times. After what seemed to be a final rejection, Wilmot went to Menzies, Robert Gordon Menzies, now leader of the opposition, and an old Melbourne contact. Menzies agreed to intervene, and within days, Curtin dropped all his objections. Why did Chester get him to do that, and how was he able to? I believe, and I have to emphasise this is speculation, that Chester found proof of Blamey's involvement in the picture fraud and politely threatened to take the story to the newspapers. Indeed, he contacted Kenneth Slessor and said, would you publish it if I give it to you? And Slessor said, who hated Blamey, he said, yes, I will. I managed to get the final piece of the puzzle from Ken Hall when I was working on Damon Parra. He was director of Cinesound and a friend of Parra's. He told me that the Australian distributors had given mint prints of all their latest releases to the AIF. So why were damaged, out-of-date prints being shown to the troops? Hall believed, and I tend to agree with him, that Blamey had given the prints to Albert Shaftoe to run in his theatres in Cairo and Palestine, hence all the rumours about money changing hands that first attracted Wilmot's attention. I don't have the final piece of paper that other historians would like, but it does seem to me plausible, and it seems to me that there is good circumstantial evidence. And so Wilmot went to Britain, covered the invasion and wrote The Struggle for Europe, none of which would have happened but for Sir Thomas Blamey.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Hill. Yep.
There is a combative relationship today between the media in the United States and Donald Trump. And fake news and truth are terms we're hearing a lot of. Wilmot, as Neil's book shows us, exemplified the commitment to truth. He paid a price for that, but was more than vindicated as one of the greatest of the correspondents and chroniclers of the Second World War. The military regulations for press covering the Second World War recognised the unavoidable tension in the relationship between correspondents and the military. It says the essence of successful warfare is secrecy. The essence of successful journalism is publicity. That distinction is well known to all of us in the media today as being fundamental to our work, even in peacetime. The war correspondents of the time acknowledged the need for censorship, but they regularly and rightly contested the limitations on their reporting. However, they also generally saw their role as part of the war effort. The reporting of some correspondents was also coloured by a sort of soft propaganda and patriotic language, and not too surprising given the times, the Australian lives that were lost, and the fact that this was a very real threat to Australia's own security. 16 ABC war correspondents, including Wilmot, covered the Second World War. That included reporters and two sound technicians. Wilmot's talent and reputation stands rightly tall among this group, but every one of them has a remarkable tale. They're sometimes ordinary men, I think, in extraordinary times. In reviewing Voices from the Air, Barry Oakley described them as unstoppable men, and I think it's a really good summation of what they were like. John Hind, who would later go on to become a well-loved and respected figure as the ABC's film reviewer for many years, was injured in a bombing raid on the beach at Hollandia. There's no doubt in my mind thereafter that he suffered from PTSD. And in the last days of his coverage of the Philippines campaign, he believed firmly every day that he was going to die. Hayden Leonard, the first ABC newsman sent into the field in the Pacific War, was badly burned in a plane crash in New Guinea, yet was back in the field 6 months later. All of them suffered malaria or dengue fever and a host of other illnesses, but they kept on going, crisscrossing the battlefields of the Second World War from one campaign to the next. Another correspondent, John Elliott, became the first ABC correspondent to die in the field when he was killed at Balikpapan very near the end of the war. But inevitably, some also died much too young after the war as a result of their wartime service. For others, relationships suffered and marriages failed, and post-war life was often challenging. They had varying talents and skills: print journalists, newly converted to the novelty and the demands of radio, broadcasters and radio technicians. Among them were soldiers, an Olympic boxer, a poet, a morning radio show host, a champion athlete. Big drinkers, big characters, quiet men and shy men. They were also notable in other ways. They were the first war correspondents for the Young National Broadcaster, the first Australian radio correspondents to cover Australians at war. And they contributed to the ABC's overall coverage of the war and the public trust in the ABC as a source of news. The First World War had been a newspaper war. The papers were the only real source of news for the Australian public. By the time of the Second World War, although still a relatively new medium, radio was already an established fact of life for many Australians, and there were more than 1 million radio licences for Australia's population of just 7 million people. Radio brought a new immediacy and visceral understanding to events on the front line. For the first time, the sounds of war, the crash and boom of gunfire, the voices of Australian soldiers on the front lines, and the voices of war correspondents reporting from the battlefield were broadcast into Australian homes. There was a reach and a power and an immediacy to radio's coverage of the war beyond that of the newspapers. In 1947, built in significant part on the success of its coverage of the war, the ABC News Service was established, independent of the news from the newspapers on which it had in part relied. This was the beginning of what is now the ABC News Service of today, and my current employer. This first group of war correspondents were also pioneers in the use of new technology and extending the capabilities of reporting from the field. The large disc recorders and other equipment used to record sound in the field and weighing up to 200 kilograms are primitive and unbelievably cumbersome by comparison with today, when better sound and more creative editing can be achieved with one single iPhone. Such recording gear travelled many thousands of miles in a utility truck across the harsh landscape of the Western Desert. The ABC field units recorded in caves, in wadis, in shell holes and in gun pits, in sandstorms that filled the grooves of the records with dust as each track was being cut, in the snow and bitter cold of Greece that so hardened the recording surfaces of the discs that the technician, Bill McFarland, mentioned by Neil, had to hug them to his chest under his greatcoat to make them soft enough to record. They recorded under the hail of small arms fire and exploding shell fire and under the rattle of falling shrapnel from anti-aircraft guns. They recorded on land and on board warships at sea. In the Pacific War, they carried the recorders in jeeps, on the backs of tanks and with the help of local porters. They waded ashore at night from landing craft with the equipment on their shoulders, in pitch black, lit only by the flash of lightning from tropical storms, and they slogged through thigh-deep, glutinous mud to the front lines of the pestilential coastal battlefields of Papua. Strange fungus grew inside the equipment, metal quickly corroded, and white mould appeared within days on the surface of the discs, and everything took time. Time to move the gear, time to record, and then to send the story back home. At Labuan in Brunei Bay in 1945, the correspondent Frank Legg and the technician Bill McFarland planned a groundbreaking recording of the naval landing. They arranged for the jeep carrying their sound recording to be the first one off the landing craft. That first jeep drove straight off the craft into 14 feet of water, and the equipment was never seen again. It was the only vehicle in the convoy to be lost. The logistics of working in the field and delivering the stories could be heartbreaking. Dispatches from the correspondent John Elliott in the Philippines were disrupted by Japanese raiding parties that cut the wire carrying his reports to the radio ship. Some recorded discs sent off through army channels disappeared from existence. Dispatches sent by shortwave were sometimes never received due to poor reception, and censorship cut the heart out of some stories or banned them altogether. While the access of the correspondents to the battlefield was extraordinary, they often travelled with the troops, and again, as Neil has mentioned with Wilmot, they sometimes carried weapons in defiance of all the rules and conventions of war. They were also limited by their accreditation that placed them under military authority. The freedom of operation for the correspondents of the ABC as the national broadcaster was sometimes more constrained than for the papers, at least in the eyes of the military. And the ABC was aware that its actions had implications. When the Director General of Army PR called disingenuously the reliability and authenticity of the ABC's reporting from the field, this was important to the reputation of the Commission and its ability to hold its own in the political currents of the time. The perception of fake news would have been very damaging to the ABC's infant news service. Bill Marion, a stubborn and occasionally hot-headed man of Irish-Italian heritage, fought bitterly against Army PR accusations of inaccuracies and misleading reporting. After covering the capture of Ley in 1943, he also opposed the Army's efforts to direct his movements in the field to the areas that they wanted covered. "I am not a soldier," he argued in a heated disagreement with one Army PR officer. This and other rows were probably a factor in his decision to leave the ABC and report the closing campaigns of the war for the Sydney Morning Herald. Frank Legg rowed with the Army over its supposed manipulation of the coverage of New Britain and limitations on his ability to work as he saw fit. Another ABC correspondent, Raymond Paul, joined with a group of war correspondents fighting Army PR over censorship and a range of grievances during the Itape campaign. As a result of this and some public statements he made about the row, Paul was not sent back into the field. The Pacific War saw a great expansion of ABC correspondents in the field. Reporters worked with field units, recording sounds and reports on the discs, and others filed news copy from the front lines and forward HQ. This greatly expanded war coverage meant that ABC correspondents were there at the beginning and at the end of the major campaigns, and Singapore is a good example. Henry Stokes was a Reuters correspondent during the Spanish Civil War and was an acquaintance of Kim Philby, then also working as a correspondent in Spain. Stokes shared hotels in the Balkans with German officers whose boots he saw outside their rooms each night waiting to be cleaned and polished for the morning. He was evacuated from the debacle of the Greek campaign together with Wilmot and the other correspondents in 1941, and the following year was the ABC correspondent in Singapore when the Japanese invaded the Malay Peninsula. He was with the Australian headquarters staff at the front during the first heavy Japanese bombardment of the Australian positions. And he escaped the island on the night that the British blew up the radio transmitters and then arrived in Java on board a British naval patrol vessel the day before news of the surrender came through. Stokes was both privately and publicly critical of the British failure in Singapore that led to the capture of many thousands of Allied soldiers, including 15,000 Australians. In 1945, Haydn Leonard arrived in Singapore with Mountbatten's fleet for the liberation of the island. He made the first shortwave broadcast from Singapore, a message from the commander of the Australian POWs in Changi Prison. The message read in part, "It has been a long wait, but now in our relief we are jubilant and grateful." Leonard went on to track down the survivors and tell the story of one of the more infamous episodes of the war, the massacre of a group of Australian nurses whose ship had been sunk fleeing the Japanese invasion in 1942. He flew to Sumatra, commandeered a car and then a train from the recalcitrant Japanese still on the island and evacuated the nurses and the other women in the poorest health. Reporting the news and the stories of Australians at war was the focus for the correspondents, but their personal stories and their reporting against formidable odds, I think, are compelling. Few people were aware that the somewhat pixie-ish but crusty John Hind, known only as the ABC film reviewer, had been there to watch MacArthur's historic steps onto the beach at Leyte in 1945, fulfilling his promise to return to the Philippines. They would not have been surprised to know just how jaundiced was Hind's view as he watched MacArthur repeat the landing several times for best effect. The heroic Australian push that drove the Japanese back along the Kokoda track was reported for radio by the ABC correspondent Dudley Leggett, following in the footsteps of Chester Wilmot. Leggett was a champion athlete of supreme fitness, but he struggled, as the soldiers did, with the daunting conditions of the terrain. And he died at a young age, only 4 years after the war, from meningitis contracted during his service in New Guinea. One of the oldest ABC war correspondents, Fred Simpson, spent long periods in the field with the diggers in New Guinea, reported on the bloody fighting against the Japanese, and listened to the tales of atrocities recounted by the POWs. Yet in 1946, when reporting from post-war Japan, he sought out the families of the Japanese midget submarine sailors who died in the attacks on Sydney Harbour, and presented them with a recording of the funeral service held for their sons in Australia. John Elliott, mentioned before, an Englishman and former Olympic boxer, a soldier and an adventurer, covered the Philippines campaign for the ABC. His death in 1945 was the end result of a chain of missed opportunities and fateful decisions. He resigned from the ABC but agreed to stay on a little longer. He then agreed to cover one more campaign. He then missed his flight home from Balikpapan and stayed one more day. And he was then shot and killed by mistake by an Australian Bren gunner who, from a distance, mistook his American cap for a Japanese soldier's. Wilmot aside, these stories of the correspondence have remained largely untold. As a journalist and reporter who's also covered conflict, I admire their reporting, but even more so the fact of their achievements against great odds.
So many thanks to our two speakers. Janet Grundy's got copies of Neil MacDonald's Valiant for Truth about Chester Wilmot, and Tony Hill's Voices from the Air about the ABC reporters, and I'm sure the authors would be happy to sign books after we finish questions and discussion. So I think if you both come up here, can I just briefly ask you both? We've got Keith Murdoch in World War One thinking he knows more about the generals in the Dardanelles campaign. We've got Chester Wilmot thinking he knows more than the generals in World War II. Was that the proper role of journalists, or was it their role to report, or did they sort of push it a bit far? Come over here. Be brief, okay?
Yeah, in Chester's case, he was working in close collaboration with the Corps commander. I mean, he's asked to go and make the report. The Corps commander is a friend and remained a friend. In fact, the last conversation they had before Chester was killed was about John Hetherington's biography of Blamey, which Chester called Hetherington an artist in whitewash. And they were talking about it. But the whole thing is that, yes, I agree, the idea of correspondents going around and giving orders, but to generals. But in a sense, Wilmot was reporting and getting information from them and questioning them closely, and therefore was getting, and he was very very thoroughly briefed and was working from briefings. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Tony, do you want to make a comment on that?
Oh, only to say I think that it is absolutely the role of journalists, war correspondents, to question everything. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think correspondents, and as Neil's writing shows, like Wilmot, were sensible, rational, intelligent men. They were not seeking to endanger security, seeking to subvert the chain of command. They had very good questions that they needed answers to, and I think that is absolutely the role of the correspondent at wartime or any time.
Nice question here.
Were any of the correspondents captured and imprisoned by the Japanese?
Were any of the correspondents captured and imprisoned by the Japanese?
No, they weren't, no. Not the ABC correspondents, no. There were others who were, BBC correspondents and others.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what was that? That chap in South Australia was, and he wrote
it. Rowan Rivett.
Rowan Rivett. Yeah,
yeah, Rowan Rivett. Edward Ward, the BBC in the Middle East, he was captured. There were quite a few that were, yeah. And there were others who... journalists who were among the prisoners of war in Changi, Murray Ferry and others as well, too.
Right, so, Anne.
How different was their experience from the experience of journalists now who we talk of being embedded with the forces? I mean, is it a similar situation, or were they a little freer?
Well, I think you've been embedded, haven't you, or close to it?
In bed or embedded,
well,
yes.
Embedded. I think we usually think embedded means that you go along with a deal, that you won't report. So where were they in this sort of scheme? They were still under command, but they seemed to be freer.
They were. They were subject to a whole range of rules and regulations governing what they could do, and the fact that they operated, their accreditation, in a sense, gave them access, but it also tied them to abide by certain rules and regulations. The most important of it was that essentially they were subject to military authority in the field. But having said that, they did have much greater freedom once they were in the field, I think, than you would see today. My own experience has been in various places having to sign documents given you by the military, which says that you will agree to abide by the authority of the military, you will do this or you won't do that. You make a decision before you undertake to sign something like that as to whether you're willing to accept it. Sometimes you are, sometimes you're not. nowadays, I think there are much greater limitations on what you can do and how you can report. I think if you are embedded with the Australian military at all, I think nowadays you are quite constrained. It is rare that they will allow you to do that, and in fact it is much more common for journalists and media to be able to arrange access to embeds with, for example, the American military in other countries, rather than for Australian journalists to arrange it here in Australia. So I think they did have extraordinary access to the battlefield in those days, and as Neil mentioned about Chester and Osmer carrying guns on the Kokoda track, I think all of the ones that I've come across at one time or another used or carried weapons, and that was partly because of the degree of access they had was so in such close proximity to the battle, and they were travelling with the troops, and the troops or the commanders of the troops would not agree to take them unless they carried a gun.
I didn't know that, and I think that's absolutely fascinating. Also, of course, Wilmot and Pera. I mean, Pera was going to were both being used to get information back to Australia by Rowell, and also by Tubby Allen. I mean, they were all part. And interestingly, in this case, they were personal friends. And it happens again to Wilmot in Europe. He's actually a friend of Montgomery's, and so was his colleague Frank Gillard, who I did meet. And Gillard got messages from Montgomery from the deathbed, and so they were all. I think it was that they were patriots, and they were all in it together, and they do what was necessary, and even act as a liaison officer. Good heavens!
And that's a really interesting thing, because that would not be. No journalist would agree to do that today. I think no. It was a different time. I think. Different circumstances, but it would not happen today.
And just by way of background, Damien Pera dies in action, right?
Yes.
Very briefly, yeah.
Damien Pera joined the Americans and was killed trying to catch the look in soldiers' eyes while he was walking backwards behind a tank. Pera, incidentally, is involved in this whole Wilmot story too. He hurries back. He knows that they're after Rowell. There were also rumours around about that Rowell was to be replaced. They're all over New Guinea, and they're all over Brisbane. And Pera hurries back with his Kokoda footage to get it on air. Ken Hall says, why don't you introduce it? And Pera, who was a pretty good political operator when he had to be, says, oh, can I mention have a tribute to the commanding general? So we have a line in, when I came back to Moresby, I was full of beans with the knowledge that General Rowell was on the job. And now he didn't actually say it as emphatically as that, we have a really fine command, because he thought the predecessor was a blamey stooge, was lousy. And he gets into it, and there's very much worry in New Guinea, when they were trying to get rid of Rowell, when Pera starts to praise Rowell in a broadcast. He was up to his neck in this as well.
Okay, there's a question here.
Given the logistical restraints that obviously the correspondents suffered, how often could they file? You know, when did we get reports
from Australia? Well, look, it's really difficult. As Neil knows, for Wilmot, it could be once a week or twice a week or whatever, but it took a long time to get things back. In the Pacific War, they had many different avenues, more avenues of being able to file. They were not only, they're much more restricted. Wilmot was much more restricted to recording and sending discs by air or going to a radio station in Cairo and broadcasting from there. Whereas the correspondents in the Pacific War, some of them did the same thing. They recorded on discs and they were then sent back through the Army PR channels, and they could take 5 days, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, sometimes they never got there. They could send telegrams from the front with the forward HQ. They had telegraphic facilities there. Or they sent information back in other forms through people who were travelling back and forth from the front. You know, if you take, for example, the Finchafen campaign, the people who were covering that could not send anything from there for the first week, and it was immensely frustrating to them. They were, in their own words, in the words of one of them, they were deeply pissed off. They could not file for a week. That was not unusual. It was very, very difficult. You know, the logistics were horrendous on occasion, but it did get better. And in New Guinea, for example, in Port Moresby, during the Pacific War, they eventually set up a direct radio telephone link. They opened a shortwave transmitter there, which meant that they could file and send their reports straight back to Australia.
In Europe, interestingly, the speed of communications became a problem. Montgomery complained to the BBC that he was spending a great deal of time disrupting the enemy's communications, only to have a very good summary of what was going on War Report that night. and so he was not worried about it, and he raised the issue with them. And it was not in a combative way. It was sort of in the sense that we've got to think about this. And indeed, you want the speed sometimes can be dangerous. Also, telling the truth can be. I mean, it's not really a good idea to broadcast that an attack is a feint. Montgomery was perfectly true, but Montgomery would rather the Germans didn't know it.
And just on that issue of speed is a really good point. In another way, for Hayden Leonard, who was the correspondent who reported, who went with Mountbatten's fleet to liberate Singapore, he had access to much better facilities to send his reports back from the radio ship by a telegraph. And they were coming back so frequently, he was filing so much copy, lengthy scripts, which you can see in the archives today, that they were swamping and flooding the ABC back in Sydney. And the ABC, which was not geared to cope with this in its form of news bulletins it had at the time, couldn't use most of it. Now, Leonard was apoplectic when he found out that most of these historic reports about the landing in Singapore, the liberation of Singapore, things happening in the streets, the meeting of the first prisoners of war and all that, most of them didn't get to air. It was just that largely he was filing so much the radio operators got them all out of sync, and then they got put to the bottom of the pile and they got delayed, or when they reached the ABC there was such a flood of them they couldn't use them.
There's a question here, and then down there.
There's sort of descriptions about Australian war journalists being at the front line, being right at the front line, and they spoke disparagingly of some of their peers in other services. Was that myth-making or was it real? And if it was real, what drove them to actually get to the front line?
Chester wrote a very interesting letter to his father when he went into action the first time at Tobruk, attacking Tobruk. And he felt that he couldn't face himself if he didn't go in and share the dangers, at least to an extent. He didn't do anything stupid. But the dust jacket has Chester on top of a house next to a sniper with a microphone in his hand in Europe. Late in the war, he was George. I did speak to someone who actually went into action with Chester. And that was George Silk, the man that took the photograph of the Rafael Inbari leaving the digger with the patch over his eye in outside Gona. And Silk said that Chester stopped at one point and I kept going and neither of us questioned the other. That Chester needed to be in a certain spot to see everything. I needed to get in closer. What he didn't know, actually, and I found out later, is Chester, when he saw George's photograph, thought was rather reproaching himself for not going in closer. But the whole point was that they made the decision in terms of where they could best get the story. And that was Chester. But Chester was very critical of people that made up their stories and reported their stories from the bar and invented them. And one of the people he was critical of was his friend Alan Moorhead, at least in a private letter to his father.
I was just going to say, I think there was Chester's reflections in a letter sent during or after the Libyan campaign was that some of the Fleet Street journalists were essentially inventing their own role in this or their own position or location. It was a report all about them when they weren't even there. And in fact, Chester in those first two battles, I think, in the Libyan campaign was, or some of the early ones, was ahead of the rest of the press pack. He was to Benghazi, certainly. and the notes he gathered from the British forces there were used by the rest of the press pack to write their stories.
Yes.
So, yeah. And Chester does write, as Neil says, about, you have to be in the best position to be there. And he wrote a very reflective letter to his family just before he came back from the Middle East, talking about why he did what he did and why he had to get to the front, because he believed that the public trusted journalists, war correspondents, who got their news from the stories from the front, not from the rear. And he had to go and do that.
Question here.
Now, I'm just checking, the ABC, in their archives, they still got a lot of the war broadcasts?
Should we say not as many as should have?
That's right.
The ABC has an appalling record in the past of not preserving its finest achievements. I did say to Sir Charles Moses, and I have to tell you, sir, we were getting on very well, and we were friends to the end of his life, and I said, look, sir, I have to tell you that I've publicly criticised you for not having archives, proper archiving. I said, why didn't you? And he said, Mr. MacDonald, we just didn't think. Mm-hmm. And, well, Moses was fundamentally an honest man, mm-hmm. and... you may be able to match blaming at infighting, but he was a decent bloke, and and they didn't really think, and they had a terrible habit, Frank Legg mentions it, of shaving those discs and reusing them, and sometimes they're absolutely vital stuff.
Priceless.
And there is a lot there. The one of the best collections, which is the one I used when I did Chester Wilmot Reports, is the collection of actual scripts that are SP300/2 in the National Archives that are here in New South Wales, and they have all the inscriptions on them and the censor and the censor notes there, and I reproduce them in the book, but some of them in the book. But and they're all and they're actually his scripts. I should mention that Raymond Paul actually used Chester's scripts as the basis for his book Retreat from Kokoda, which is actually one of the first book to deal openly with the Kokoda campaign. He got a very good access to Arnold Potts, and there was a systematic campaign by Herring and a couple of other of Blamey's cronies to discredit him in the Argus. Mm.
The audio, Neil's right, there's about 70 pieces of audio left in the ABC archives dating back from the World War II, which are of the voices of ABC war correspondents. Some of those are just excerpts, snippets in broader pieces, but some of them are the full reports. Most of the ones that are kept in full are Wilmot's. And likewise with the scripts themselves, as Neil says, there are a lot of them. I have scanned thousands of pages of these things from the archives. There are many, many pages of scripts in the archives. Most of the complete sets, again, are Wilmot's.
Yes.
For very good reason.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the BBC is somewhat better. Not ideal by any means. They have their scandals too. But the BBC had a very good... They were kind enough to give me a set of Wilmot's reports, and they are very good.
So, very briefly, what's the very good reason that Wilmot's are preserved? Because he was more important than the others, or...?
Yeah, look, I think there's no doubt that Wilmot stands head and shoulders above the rest of the war correspondents. I think he was, you know, the finest war correspondent the ABC had at the time by a long measure.
He's probably one of our greatest journalists, and also Struggle for Europe is a magnificent book, and it's still, I think, a classic, and it should be reprinted as quickly as possible. And the other one is that Tobruk is splendid, and in Tobruk, of course, he doesn't write about himself. There's a few little autobiographical things, but as he pointedly put in Just Jacket, it is a book about the history and not about the correspondent.
Now, just for our people on a podcast, just to finish up with Wilmot, he dies in a plane crash in 1954.
That's right.
Okay, final question.
Just wanted to go back to the medium. You talk about radio being very important, but there was also Movietone News in the war. Now, did any of our correspondents get to report through the Movietone News and actually get go on screen, or was that done elsewhere?
No, there is only a very small amount of moving pictures, image film of ABC war correspondents. There is a little bit of Frank Legg from the opening of the radio station in Port Moresby during the war. And there is a little bit of Dudley Leggett, the war correspondent who I mentioned who went on the Kokoda track, who was the extraordinarily fit champion athlete who died very young after the war. And in that bit of footage of Dudley Leggett, it's during a sports carnival day at Port Moresby for the soldiers. And Dudley is taking part in the high jump, which he wins. And you can see him doing the high jump. There's no sound on it, unfortunately, but you can see him doing winning the high jump, jumping the bar, and then talking afterwards to somebody, but there's no sound. So there's, I think, a little bit of footage maybe of one other, Peter Hemery, somewhere in the War Memorial, that I haven't tracked down, but it's very, very minimal.
And there's not the movie town, the footage, of course, is, of course, the para stuff. The power material is there, and not that he films. There's a little bit of film of him on in the field, a tiny bit of him with the commandos, where they photographed with his own camera by one of the other commandos with us when he was with the 2nd, 5th Independent Company. But I would just stress that the interesting thing is the fact that White's, both his dispatches and Green Armour, Chester's dispatches, and the Kokoda footage, not just the newsreel, though the newsreel is important too, and the Movietone version of it, Road to Kokoda, all, in fact, give an extraordinary coverage in several mediums of the Kokoda campaign. You can do a very good... There's more research to be done working from the media performance.
One little final coda to that, which is a slightly quirky thing, is that Len Edwards was the other sound recording technician with the ABC correspondents in the Pacific War, and there was a Hollywood film that they were premiering for the troops in New Guinea, and I forget the name of the film, but it was a big blockbuster. And they premiered it for the troops in the bush, and they were sitting on bully beef cases and watching this film. And Len was asked to go around with his sound recorder and record interviews and responses with the troops to get their feeling, you know, their responses to the movie. And then when it actually had its proper premiere in New York or in Hollywood, wherever it was, they then played those recordings of the soldiers and their thoughts about the movie during the Hollywood premiere. So it was, a slightly quirky little odd thing.
So it's a good time to end with Hollywood, I think. Look, thanks to Tony Hill and to Neil MacDonald for coming and talking today. I mean, it's 7 decades ago and the world's changed so much and the media's changed so much since then. But those who recorded Australia's engagements in the Second World War for the ABC and others are well worth remembering. And it's an important book by Neil MacDonald, biography of Chester Wilmot, and by Tony Hill, looking at the various ABC war correspondents, of which John Hine is the best known, but he was one of many at the time who did the important work. So, as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of both books outside tonight, but for tonight, well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.